Gym. Selection. You're listening to Industrial Evolution, where we're exploring how industrial enterprise leaders can use emerging technologies to stay competitive. I'm your host, Chad Perry, CTO, software engineer, and digital strategy expert, and I'm interviewing the most innovative companies in the world to reveal the future of how we make, grow, move, and power things. These are the pioneers who are shaping the future of manufacturing, agriculture, transportation, energy, and every other industrial sector. In each episode, we're looking at key technologies, state of the market, the challenges of adopting technology into an organization, and success stories of early adopters who have been able to revolutionize their business on the back of these innovations. You can find more episodes and guest information on our website, evolution.industrial.fm. Enjoy the show. Today, we're speaking with two individuals from Epicor, a global provider of business management software for small to mid-market enterprises in the manufacturing and distribution sectors. Epicor was started all the way back in 1972, so they've been at it since the very beginning of the age of ERP software, when companies actually had to manage their own servers and databases, and if you didn't, you were just out of luck. But now, Epicor is leading their customers into the future with a comprehensive cloud-based platform that has moved well beyond core business data and into the realm of IoT, analytics, and other data-intensive capabilities that are only beginning to be possible in a highly connected environment with ever more cost-effective sensors and machines. So with us today is Terry Hiskey and Stephen Edgington. Now, in her role as VP of Global Product Marketing, Terry has broad insight into market trends arising from Epicor's base of 20,000 customers across the world. And Stephen, in his role as VP of Engineering, is squarely on the front lines of the emerging technology that is becoming critical to stay competitive. So between the two of them, Terry and Stephen have a unique vantage point on the challenges that SME manufacturers and distributors are facing as data and technology become necessary for survival. But at the same time, resources remain constrained and companies are left wondering where to start with such a complicated subject. So Terry, great to have you with us today, all the way out of Austin, Texas.
Chad, so pleased to be here. Thank you for inviting us to participate in this podcast.
And Stephen, likewise, thank you for joining us from the United Kingdom.
Yep, looking forward to it.
Now, Terry, you've been involved with enterprise tech for a while from the product marketing side. So tell me a little bit about your background and how you arrived at Epicor.
Sure. Yeah, I've been doing marketing for well over, it's been about 25 years. It's been almost exclusively in the manufacturing industry. I've worked, for manufacturers on the shop floor, in a marketing role. So I've seen, was able to actually see and be part of a shop floor from my little window where I was managing trade shows and doing things like that, all the way through my career, working for small manufacturers up to very large enterprise software manufacturing vendors, and ended up at Epicor about 4 years ago as they were going through their own transformation in terms of going from being great enterprise ERP provider and really moving their business to the cloud. And that's when I came here, about four years ago now. So that's really been my journey. I've been really lucky to work with manufacturers almost my whole career, both from, working directly for manufacturers and then working for software vendors that provide solutions for manufacturers and all the way from product lifecycle management from the very beginning when someone has an idea for a product, through production, through manufacturing, through servicing, warranty, and things like that. So I've been lucky enough to see a lot of change and really see how technology has really impacted the change in the industry.
And Stephen, You also have a really interesting background with very deep experience in ERP implementations and enterprise software development. And that's something that resonates with me because that's my background as well. So I'd really like to hear about how you also arrived at Epicor, especially coming out of the implementation background and getting into a leadership role at this company.
Well, I'm going to take you back a little bit further because I think it paints a good picture. When I was young, about 6 or 7, I always used to love taking things apart, whether it's like engines in my dad's shed to try and put on the back of a go-kart, or watches and computers. And so that kind of curiosity and going into things and seeing how things worked really kind of caught my interest. And electronics and computers were kind of everything. That's what I would spend all my days and nights doing. And when I was in college, about 17, I had a job. I was a glass collector in one job, and I was also working in a little factory that was actually building industrial PCs and battery packs. And the company's called Steertite. And at the time, they had this AS400 system, this old 80s kind of system. But I was surrounded by electronics and technology and building battery packs for deep sea and building PCs and servers for battleships. So I was in my element there learning about how this stuff works. And at the same time, sort of seeing the perspective of being on the shop floor and also working with the business that was looking to upgrade, this is showing my age, back from NT4 Windows 2000 and going from this AS400 system, that was built out in the 80s, to actually an Epicor product that was called Vista 3.2. So basically, I kind of had that exposure to understanding what an ERP system was straight from there. And after that, I basically set up my own business with the operations manager that was working at that company. And so from 2002 to 2016, we built an IT consultancy. We kind of grew that business to over 42 people consulting all around the world on ERP products, not just Epicor, Dynamics, and supporting IT businesses all around the UK. So, very unique, different perspective. I was always into the technologies. After college, I continued on to university, did computer science, software engineering, and then took that kind of knowledge back into the ERP products to kind of, mold them into the business and automate everything away. So, a bit of a different kind of background, but, it wasn't work. It's just fun because all I'm learning about and sort of, getting curious about was technology and electronics and how this applies to software.
I'm glad you mentioned the AS400s because I'd like to talk about the basics of ERP for a minute. Most business leaders already understand the value of data and automation, but ERP can also get a bad rap sometimes for being these giant, overly complicated software solutions that just tend to slow you down and cost a fortune to buy and maintain. And I think perhaps a lot of that comes from the legacy ERPs and the headaches that came along with that coming out of the 80s and 90s where you had to have your own systems. So what does a modern ERP look like, and what makes for a good solution that actually delivers on the potential value of data and automation?
Well, let me give you a little bit of a history of how the kind of platforms have changed. I think it's good. So we started with mainframes, where we had this kind of mainframe and a terminal that everyone would connect into. Everyone would know it with like a green screen. And, amazingly, there's still companies out there that we come across that are using these systems. So typically, very fast for data entry because, people know how to be keyboard warriors and move around them. But you could never get the data out. You couldn't query it. There's no visualizations, absolutely no APIs, no way to really get things done. It was purely sort of data entry, hit a button, run a batch job, wait a few hours and get reels of paper off that then, will run the factory. Many companies still run that way today. It kind of then moved on to client server. And in fact, back, in my story back in around the 2001 time, that's what Epicor's product used to be, a client server then product that you had a fat client on the front end, a database and application logic on the back end. And, those systems were better because they could scale better and you could connect remotely through dial-up and things like that. But it still wasn't very easy to manipulate, easy to change, or even automate. These systems sort of did it one way and you had to conform to how it did that. The next phase we kind of went to, and a lot of different kind of technology platforms went to was this kind of three-tier architecture, this sort of notion of having the database separate from the application logic and then having the client separate from that. And, you know, Epicor also had that N-tier architecture, which allowed for scale. You know, and as a kind of ERP provider, that really did help us scale to the bigger sites, the bigger needs, and, you know, the growing demands on data, moving away from things like embedded 4GL logic in Progress, which Epicor used to be built on many years ago, to kind of SQL Server and more modern backends. And now what you sort of see is, you know, the client is sort of disappearing, it's evaporating into the browser, and the backend is now not a server on your premises, it's in the cloud, it's serverless functions, it's, you know, planet scale data storage, and you don't have to worry about that anymore. So I think it's interesting when you look back of this thin terminal that connected to the mainframe that you used to run on premise and have to look after and maintain, to now in effect, you know, you're kind of plugged into the cloud where the clients are disappearing, but actually like edge devices are becoming more important, where we're connecting, you know, our batteries back into the grid, you know, providing this sort of nervous system in the factory to get that connected feedback. And it's all about what we see. It's all about speed and agility. You know, these systems have gone from being very rigid, being hard to manipulate, being very long to kind of get implemented, you know, to now, you know, speed is of the essence and the time to value is so important. And the companies that are now looking to get these kind of cloud native based ERP systems are the ones that, you know, need to be able to make decisions quickly and need to be able to, you know, see in real time, you know, what's going on to be able to compete.
I think the other thing, you know, the other reason why, or another reason perhaps that ERP has gotten a bad rap is that from a customer's point of view, how complex it is to understand it and how to interact with it. You know, back in when ERP was kind of on the rise in the you know, late 80s, early 90s, people would have to go to training for a week, you know, to understand how to even input and interact with the ERP system. And I think that, you know, as we are, you know, in moving, you know, towards the future, and the consumer experience is such, when you start to interact with technology, you don't need training. You should be able to use an app or use software pretty much right off the bat and be guided by that software. I think that ERP is being forced to follow that as well. And so I think that, you know, where ERP is improving as well as with the user experience. And, you know, not, you don't just have one person now that is highly trained in using ERP and interacting with the system, but you have many, many people that can, you know, both input and get information out of the system in a much easier way. So I would say that, you know, that's also one reason why ERP, when you look at modern ERP, it's who interacts with it, how they interact with it, and the ease at which they're able to get the information that they need.
Right. And that really tells a story of an evolution and a convergence of user experience, data, how we operate, the culture of the company. All of these things are changing in lockstep. And it feels like we're at this inflection point where now we've gotten to this point where we have cloud software. Most people in an organization are able to quickly and easily take advantage of it, assuming it's a good product and it's set up properly and there's a little bit of guidance there. But now we're looking at the future, right? So there's what does this enable for us? So now that we've gotten to this point where I would say this is really a baseline of what software should be and should do now. And now we're really at this point where we're about to see what can really be done with it. So what is the future? What is the next 10 years of ERP look like from your perspective? Terry, let's start with you and then come back to Stephen.
Well, I'll echo what I just said about the experience. I think that it will be increasingly easy for people to be able to interact with it really by your persona. So if I'm a financials person, I should be able to access that financial data, my dashboard, in a much easier way than perhaps, you know, you were able to 10 years ago, and you're getting to a point where you're able to do that now. I think it will be more apps driven, perhaps, so that if you're a salesperson, instead of having to access an entire ERP system, you're just going to want to interact with the workflows and the processes that are applicable to you as a salesperson. And so you will have your own view of ERP, you'll have your own flows that will be personalized to your experience, which again is different from a more generalized experience, which is where we're coming from. So, you know, I think that's where we're going to, you know, start to see ERP evolve from a user side anyways, of it being a more personalized experience for the user, easier to get to information, better matched to my role and what I want to get out of the system.
If we look at actually what's available today, you know, a lot of the manufacturers out there are not taking advantage of really the capabilities that are all around us. So what we're kind of seeing now, just in the whole industry, is this kind of concept of the citizen developer, the low code, no code abilities, the kind of freedom to make the system do exactly what I need it to do, to automate the steps that are pointless, to, you know, kind of interface and interact with all the other things around us. You know, whether it's kind of getting Uber to come and pick up something and deliver it in, you know, in an emergency or kind of expedited process, whether it's kind of like pulling in market information or kind of customer churn details or, you know, signals that can help us reason about data. So, you know, that technology is all there. And when you look at IoT and Industry 4.0, you know, there's a lot of companies out there that don't have, you know, connected factories. And what we're going to start to see, and we've seen it more and more, is when you know, let's sort of step back. What do you need an ERP system? You need an ERP system to be able to make faster decisions. And if you're producing something, you know, if you're kind of making physical things, that's hard. You've got to coordinate lots of different aspects. And if you're trying to grow and do that in a pandemic as well, you know, with uncertain market times, you need to make sure that you're not missing a beat, that you've got your raw materials, that you know the lead times, that you know the supplier, the qualities, the testing, the shop floor time collection, etc. You need all the basics. And like you said, that's just the baseline. But what you also need to do is be ready for how do you actually start making products that are connected. You know, so it's not just your factory being connected, it's having your supply chain connected and having the products that you make being capable of being intelligent as well. Because if you don't, you're going to get somebody else go and do it, whether it's a kind of bolt or, you know, a kind of bed or a kind of desk. All these things are going to start to need and to kind of breathe and have systems and digital cores that can support that kind of transition. So, you know, 10 years is a big, you know, long time. I'm going to go into that in a little bit more. But, you know, in the near term, we've kind of got this disruption happening where it's all about, you know, getting more lean, but actually doing it in a digital way and making sure that your data quality is good, your systems are connected, and you are removing waste. You know, whether that's somebody pressing buttons or that's someone, you know, kind of moving stock automatically that you could put a robot in to do, or you could, you know, automatically hold less stock because you can see the visibility of the supply chain. You know, all these things are now kind of possible, and our customers are doing that. So, you know, examples of things that, you know, products that we have today that are changing how our companies are working, you know, simple things like our Commerce Connect, you know, manufacturers being able to actually trade straight into a website. You know, this technology is not new, but for manufacturers, you know, it is being able to configure to order through the site. So you can in effect choose, you know, exactly the parameters you need and then make just what's needed and look up, you know, the lead times, the capability to promise for those things. We've got, you know, aspects, you know, products like Collaborate that allows you to talk about business entities with people inside and outside of your organization. So, you know, the social platforms that we've got today that everyone's used to, and Twitter and Instagram, Facebook, you know, people are, you know, expect to be able to talk about a topic and around things. And so inside of ERP systems, the invoice or the job that has a problem, you want to be able to communicate and in effect collaborate around those things with people inside and outside of your business, whether it's your suppliers or your customers, you know, reducing that latency of communication allows you to make faster decisions, allows you to kind of, you know, win the business that you may not otherwise do. So that's where we've kind of, you know, that's the current technology, the products we've got out there. We've got, you know, Commerce Connect. We've got things like Collaborate. We have things like Eva, which is our Epicore virtual agent, which is, you know, a chatbot type interface with skills, a bit like Amazon's Alexa, but the skills are, you know, specific to an ERP. So, you know, as a salesperson, you can check part on-hand quantities, you can convert a quote, you can create a quote, you can receive in stock. So what we're, you know, that's ahead of the curve really to what the market currently expects, but they're exactly the types of things that the new generation that's coming into the workforce expects. You know, they're at home. My son, just, you know, on his 11th birthday, he just asks Alexa to turn on and off his light. Yeah, when he gets into the workforce in the factory, he's going to expect to be talking to the machine, because that's what the next generation are conditioned to do. They expect touch, they expect immediate response, they expect feedback. And so, you know, the ability for companies to do that requires this digital core. Now, when we look a little bit further into the future, you know, just recently, OpenAI released the GPT-3 kind of APIs algorithm. And this is, you know, caused quite a bit of a stir. It's interesting, an AI model that you can basically, you know, kind of enter in text and ask questions, and it will reason about responses. You can ask it what the population of the US is. You can ask it to reword a poem in someone else's kind of genre. And, you know, this AI is pretty powerful. And so taking those scenarios, you know, the other example I saw just the other day was, you know, in a design tool like Figma, which allows you to design websites, you can now just say, hey, give me a new website, but make it look like Apple. Yeah. And so you just describe what you want and it will design you the system. So, you know, the technology and AI is starting to get to a level where we can automate even more and be even less precise about what we want to do, what we want to achieve. You know, our Eva chatbot, you know, does natural language processing, but it doesn't always process all those kind of edge cases. Whereas, you know, being able to just describe what you want and then an AI algorithm and machine learning model be able to infer that, you know, we're moving to the realms of being able to describe, you know, a particular part, and in effect have those, that generative design process it, or be able to describe the data I want in a query and have that query written for me. So although today we're in these low code, no code tools, you know, the ability to just be a normal user, a business user, a shop floor user, and getting the data that you want out of the system, or making the system do what you want to do and automate it like you could do on your iPhone, those types of things are just expected. But I think in the future, as we go through these innovations in AI, we'll start to see, you know, kind of looser interface mechanisms with systems. And then if we sort of also then look at what we're seeing in the manufacturing space around innovations in 3D printing, you know, how I see it is that, you know, the factories in 10 years time, we'll be talking about factories more like kind of farms growing product, and, you know, nurturing product that, you know, in effect does then have a identity and has a life that, you know, continues as it moves out of the factory. And, you know, the advances in 3D printing, the ability to kind of ensure we verify the authenticity of where this has come from, those are the types of things, you know, that are really, you know, interesting as we look forwards into the next decade.
It's almost like we're in the calm before the storm, where everybody is getting their basics in place. We have the technology, we have the cloud. So companies are catching up, the market is catching up to having this baseline of data sharing and input and connectivity. And now we've got all these other technologies on the horizon, like machine learning and artificial intelligence, edge computing, more advanced analytics. We didn't even talk about virtual reality or augmented reality or IoT yet. And yet there has to be some sort of core to all of this. There has to be some sort of orchestration piece. And so I think of ERP as the core platform to enable all of that. So how does that fit into your concept, your worldview of the ERP and how you're growing? Because I know you've recently released products and modules around IoT data analytics and stuff like that. So where does that fit in?
Yeah. So I think, you know, you touched on a good point. So my view is that, you know, every business independent of manufacturers needs a kind of digital core, needs a system, a kind of backbone, which is going to be holding together all of your core areas. And you need a system that's sort of designed, it's got the DNA of, you know, the kind of business that you're in. There's many companies out there, you know, there's low code tools, there's platforms that might go and do one specific thing, but you've got to pull it together and orchestrate it and have a kind of, you know, a source of truth for things like your customers, for your parts, for your product information, for your engineering change, for your jobs and serial numbers and traceability. You know, you need to have core things in place, but you need to also have systems that are open that can easily interface to other systems and can orchestrate and automate those processes, because you need to have data feeds. So you need data coming in, you need your data warehouse, you need to have the ability to easily automate processes, to capture extra data, to, you know, notify external systems, to synchronize aspects. So, you know, to me, you need to have a digital core. And then as an example with IoT, you know, we work very closely with Microsoft and Azure, and there is no way Epicore can compete with the likes of AWS or Azure on IoT. It's just, you know, the security required to get that right, the technical innovations over, you know, some of the abilities to do preventative maintenance over the streams of data and the ingesting of that data. It's just, you know, it's just a lot of hard engineering problems that have been solved. So what we do at Epicore is we've built modules and made it super simple to create both connected products and associate IoT devices with any aspect of the digital core of your ERP system. So we can do things like take a button off the shelf that's IoT enabled and make it so that when you walk up to it in the shop, in the on your production bench, if you press that button, that'll send a signal to Azure securely, and that'll then push the signal to your ERP system, whether it's in the cloud or it's on-premise. And so with that, you can automate any process. You can make that create a purchase order, receive it, move stock, you know, absolutely any of the transactions you might want to process in a business, you can make it do. So you've got this ability now to really rethink your whole factory, because whether it's a PLC machine that you're reading with OPC, that you're able to kind of read spindle speeds and vibration details, that can all be pushed up and that can be given an identity and then associated with an entity in your ERP system. So it could be associated with a part, a jig, a tool, a machine, a person. You know, if you wanted to kind of, you know, now have sort of like proximity tags on employees and when they're in areas, be able to kind of automatically collect their time on jobs, and as they walk out of areas, collect their time, you know, you can do that. You know, you can also do things like, you know, make sure they don't get too close, or do contact tracing. You know, all that data, everything that's connected basically feeds into Azure and IoT hub, and then that hub we allow inside of the ERP system to associate it. So, you know, we allow companies to kind of get to an industry 4.0 and a kind of IoT enabled space without having to understand how to make any of that work, because you can now get these off the shelf products, and machines are even coming out now with upgrades that just allow them to natively work. Once that's connected to your IoT hub, which we allow all of our customers to have their own to keep their data all secure and safe and isolated, that can then easily interact with your ERP system. And so whether it's collecting the vibration information or vision camera pictures from a kind of quality test back into Azure, and then using stream analytics or, you know, applying ML models to it to look for anomalies, and then based on what's found, those sort of boundaries you establish, getting that to then drive functions, whether it's a message in Collaborate that gives you a heads up to your supervisor that's currently logged in to the system to tell them, hey, go and check this machine out, it looks like something's wrong. pushing that to Eva, our chatbot, to ask him, what would you like to do? Would you like to go and raise a maintenance job, yes or no? So this IoT capability allows some really powerful scenarios. And so visualizing them on the into our home pages, into our application, allows you to, as an operator, get visibility of the shop floor without being there. And then also being able to make that bi-directional, where you can even take actions and maybe shut the machine down or take other processes. That becomes really powerful as a capability.
Yeah, and I think you made a really important distinction there. I want to come back to Terry. I want to come back to you in a minute here associated with this, but you made a really important distinction there, and that is that of capabilities versus just these raw technologies. And I think that comes back to what Terry said earlier about customers needing out-of-the-box solutions that just work. So Terry, can you comment a little bit more on that?
Yeah, of course. I was just going to finish a thought that Steve, you had mentioned before about this feeling like the calm before the storm a bit. And, I've just come off of a couple of days of virtual customer advisory boards with some of our executive customers. And it's interesting because I think the pandemic has been definitely provided a sense of urgency for a lot of our customers in terms of adopting and looking at this technology. I mean, certainly our manufacturers have heard of IoT for a long time. They understand the value of analytics. They understand the need for digital transformation, but I think prior to the pandemic, they weren't on any sort of timeline as when they needed to get there, just sometime soon. And when the pandemic hit, it's amazing the number of stories that I've heard of, these conservative, small, mid-sized customers, very risk averse, that weren't ready to change over paper-based processes, but were forced to because of the pandemic. And when Steven talks about needing that digital core, that was something that our customers talked about, that we were happy that, that they were happy that they had Epicor as their digital core, that they were able to, move paper-based processes to automation through a solution like our enterprise content management solution, DocStar. And that they were able then to, think about not just, theoretically think about how you would leverage IoT, but understanding the value when you have to talk about social distancing and how many people can be on a shop floor, at any one time, and understanding that, wow, if we actually had IoT hooked up to our machines, that we were able to remotely monitor the fluid or the vibrations instead of having to have an operator go in. That's not just a nice to have anymore. That's a necessary thing that they need. And so it's been interesting to actually see this pandemic, really spur a lot of our customers into action in terms of adopting these technologies. Now, in terms of kind of out of the box solutions, it's because a lot of our customers are faced with challenges. They have, just yesterday I was hearing on the shop floor that a lot of manufacturers were forced to furlough people. A lot of them are not able to get those employees back. And so, in an industry where they were already suffering from workforce shortages, now the people that they already had trained are out and perhaps aren't coming back in any kind of, with any kind of speed, or certainly not the number of people that they need that they were having, in those jobs before. So you're having newer workers come onto the shop floor, you have less people than before. And so you need to have solutions that are easy to interact with and something that doesn't take a lot of training for someone to understand. One of our customers echoed this, saying, I don't have time to train people, every month because I'm getting new workers coming in every month. I need something that, workers can understand right away within a couple of hours, that they can use the experience that they have from interacting with consumer applications and have a very similar intuitive experience with their software in order to be more productive, right away and not have to make up that learning curve. So I really think that, you know, that these outside forces are forcing companies to look at solutions and look at how technology can help solve problems. And that as technology providers, we need to make it easier for people to use and to understand and access, because knowing that, you know, these are the labor shortages that a lot of our manufacturers are having to deal with. And so we want to make sure that, you know, right off the bat or as soon as possible, when they bring workers on board, that they can be productive sooner in order to, you know, keep the business going and keep everything running.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And contingency planning and diversity and resilience, those were all very important. They've always been important for a business, but the supply chain shock and just the overall shock of having to go remote, having to deal with training issues, all of these things have just piled on since the pandemic. And what you're telling me is that you're actually now getting feedback from the market that people are dealing with this problem. And I hear a fork in the road. I'm hearing you describe, I'm actually picturing this as being a pivotal moment in history, really for the world, for a lot of different markets, but in particular for manufacturing because of the scope of the problems that we're talking about, where you either adopt this digital core, this competitive baseline, this platform from which you can grow, or you don't. What is your take on what that difference looks like in just a handful of years from now? Who are going to be the winners coming out of this? And what's going to happen to the people who just don't have the resources or can't find a way to make this work?
We're seeing lots of change come from the pandemic. Obviously, you know, deprioritizing the kind of, as much as you can, some of the supply from, say, China, looking at kind of bringing things closer to shore, looking at maybe breaking up those larger manufacturing sites, but it's expensive, you know, and there's a lot of opportunity, you know, especially as I look in the UK space, but around the world. But you have got these problems with like the raw earth materials that, you know, do require things coming from certain places. So, you know, interestingly, there's a lot of, you know, kind of research and things going on just before the pandemic in things like the factory in a box concept that came from the MTC in the UK. And that was, you know, the principle of, you know, being able to containerize in some ways the kind of bits of your factory so that you can redeploy them to where you need to, so that you can get capabilities closer to the customers. And, you know, and the best example of that is Amazon with regards to its distribution network and what they've done across Amazon basic ranges. And so when you look forwards at, you know, those that have kind of been able to kind of really thrive in, you know, these situations, it's the ones that have got the digital core. It's the ones that are kind of doing the harder things and have got the networks established and the connections already in foot. So, you know, you've got to think about, well, if Amazon ever started, you know, producing, doing light assembly or manufacturing, you know, how would you as a manufacturer work in a scenario that it was a kind of third party play, you know, where you can in effect rent your capabilities back to a bigger kind of network. So, you know, I think if you're running your business off Excel and Access, or you've got old systems and you haven't invested, you know, I see a lot of manufacturing companies that will happily invest $1 million or pounds into plant equipment, but they don't see the value of software because it's not tangible or they can't see it yet. And I think that's partly a generational thing of the people that are running the businesses, you know, aren't familiar with the power and the effects that you can have from actually executing that properly. So, you know, I'm completely in agreement that, you know, we're at this point where I think we'll unfortunately lose a lot of skilled manufacturers if they can't invest, or we don't have government schemes and the, you know, make it really super simple. Now, on the plus side of that, the SaaS kind of equations over OPEX and CAPEX, where, you know, now you don't have to spend $1 million or X amount on these software systems. You can basically just subscribe to it. You don't have to buy any equipment. You know, you can just basically start implementing. That's where now the kind of focus moves to the ability to kind of realize that value. How fast can you get up and running? What's your minimal viable needs to really kind of solve that problem. And you know, I think that's what we're going to see more and more. And hopefully those manufacturers which are at that cusp of making a decision on what do I do next, they'll see that to compete, to continue to kind of, you know, be resilient, you have to get digital and you have to choose a system that's going to be able to grow with you. And you've got to have a plan.
I would say that anyone who doesn't have, you know, that digital core in place, if they don't have any plans for digital transformation, I mean, they're in trouble. It's, you know, this is, the world is changing. And I think that, you know, if you're not looking at it the right way, or you're, I guess, not acknowledging that change. If you're, you know, seeing, and, you know, Stephen had mentioned, you know, there are manufacturers that invest millions of dollars on capital equipment for the shop floor. In talking to one of our manufacturing VPs, we actually had a conversation about this with regards to IoT. And he said, why would you invest millions in, you know, equipment when you pay a worker, for example, you know, whatever their salary is? Generally, you meet with them a couple times a year to check in and find out what's going on. And you set expectations and you want a certain amount of work out of that employee. Why wouldn't you consider an investment in a machine the same way? Like, that's where IoT comes into play, and that you can start managing the output of these investments and understanding what the baseline is and understanding when, you know, that equipment needs to be serviced and all of that. Why wouldn't you do that? Why wouldn't you want to protect your investments in the same way that you treat your employees in terms of the output that you would want from them and the improvements that you would make from them? And you know, if you don't do that, I think you're being short-sighted for sure.
Well, that's actually a really good question. Why wouldn't you do that? And I think that as a small business owner or a manager of a mid-market company, there are legitimate reasons, or there are what feel like legitimate constraints around being able to do this. And what I've found is it seems like most of those are cultural problems in terms of innovation, just mindset overall. You've got this gap, this kind of generational gap between a digitally native incoming culture that has expectations, and then you've got masters of trade that tend to be older and more established. And so you've got these cultural problems as well as the real world constraints of running a business and making investments. So what kind of objections do you typically see when you talk to a company that is in that small to mid market? They understand the value, or at least in theory they do, but they just can't take that next step for some reason.
Where I've seen problems, and this goes back to having, you know, more out of the box solutions, where I've seen problems is that these small and mid-sized companies understand the value of it, but they're resource constrained. They're lean already. They don't have resources to invest in what they think might be a really in-depth, you know, project that they can't see an ROI on it right away. So they don't have a data scientist. They don't have maybe a resource to understand the value of IoT, you know, as it relates to remote monitoring of a machine, for example. And where our customers have come to us is to ask, you know, they would like to see out-of-the-box solutions. Tell us where we can get value. You know, do you have a solution? You know, what should we be measuring from a machine? And it's so hard because every, you know, shop factory, every shop floor is a little bit different, but there are some common things that a lot of these guys want to, you know, track, whether it's production levels or oil fluid levels or vibration or all of these things. And so they're starting to come to us and ask us, well, based on your interactions with other manufacturers, what are they tracking? Because maybe we can track that as well. We just don't even know where to start. And I think it's really that whole thing of, like, you can give them some tools, but if they don't know where to apply them, you know, they just look at the tools. But if you can give them a path or a template or some way using those tools in a way that they can easily understand and feel like that they can see ROI from, it makes their journey easier. It doesn't take up the resources, you know, those precious resources that they are already short on. So I really think it goes back to understanding what that customer need is and helping provide them a solution, a template, a path to get to, you know, a better, more efficient, you know, operation.
what you're describing is really a perception problem, right? Because there are legitimate challenges in a business. But what I hear and what you just described with your customers as well is that they come to you with this expectation that it's going to be costly or complicated. And then on top of that, they don't even really know what they need, right? And that comes back to understanding what you're trying to get out of your business. So this is the strategy that I think business owners and executives can actually own and do something about before they ever even have a conversation about technology. You mentioned vibrations and oil levels. Well, if those are critical to your business, you already know that those are critical to your business. You may not be aware that there is a simple solution to track that and to actually be able to get the information that you need out of your system, or if you're evaluating a system for purchase. So what kind of conversations do you have with your customers to try to help them overcome that inability to see their own business for what they actually already know?
The art of the possible is what people can't kind of fathom. They don't, unless they can see it, it's hard to sort of realize they actually even need it. So one thing we do at Epicor is we've actually got what we call a labs team. And that labs team is really not, you know, not doing billable work. We send the team into companies that, you know, for free, and we work with them. We walk the shop floor and we sort of look and ask questions and say, oh, you know, do you know you could do this? Or why aren't you doing that? You know, and just as an example, you know, we kind of went to one of our customers, walked around the shop floor, and we noticed that there's, you know, lots of shared terminals, lots of old PCs that are touch screens that people are using, and they're kind of queuing behind them, clocking into jobs, clocking out of jobs, walking back to their stations. And, you know, we kind of, you know, that was just one thing of the day. But when we sat down with the operations director, you know, he sort of did a bit of a calculation and sort of worked out they could save, you know, $500,000 with just the amount of time people are walking and waiting to clock into a job and out of a job. And he could justify putting a machine on everyone's desk, yeah, or a tablet to be able to clock in and clock out automatically and save on, you know, all that walk time. So those are, you know, just simple examples. Another example though was, you know, we were looking again in the factory and one of the operators was, cutting pipes. And as they cut the pipe, they then weld on a kind of an end connector. And once they've done that welding, they'll use an endoscope to check the weld is good. And, you know, this is a kind of, you know, a skilled process because you've got to be able to know if that weld is good or not. Later on in the assembly, they test the pressure. So that's fine, but it's too late to kind of correct. So you've got to make sure that weld is good. And although they had automatic welding robots in other parts of the factory, this part was still manual. And so, you know, we basically explored, hey, if we took a feed off that camera, fed that to a machine learning model, and we added a button so the operator could press a button if it was bad, we'd be able to train a machine learning algorithm on what a good weld looks like, what a good weld doesn't look like, and in effect then drive that process. And that allows them to have that skilled operator, you know, kind of that, you know, could be replaced by someone not as skilled or just catch more issues in the process. So that's kind of like just, you know, two simple examples where our customers don't necessarily know what they need. They don't know what's possible. And how that becomes an IoT button that sends back the signal and the data from the camera feed just goes into a data lake. You know, those solutions they don't understand because they just want to run the business. They're just the kind of factory managers. And you know, what our job is to show the art of the possible. And then that can become, you know, kind of packaged product that can then be repeated and trained and those things can be taken forwards. And just one other example, just because you touched on oil, you know, one of our customers in the Netherlands, you know, when we walked their factory and we were looking at different things there, you know, they were telling a story that the one day they came in, and this company is forward looking. So they wanted to put meters on their oil drums and their pumps because they came in one day and they had 2 inches of oil. You know, for the whole of the shop floor, they lost 2 days of production to clean it all up because they had a failure on one of the pumps for the oil. So, you know, when no one's there, after hours, these things can still go wrong. And, you know, 2 days of production, missing that big contract, and then, you know, letting your customers down, you know, for the cost of some simple monitoring and alerting, you know, in hindsight, it seems, you know, kind of crazy not to do it. But, you know, before that, it seems questionable. Like, well, I don't understand how it all works.
Yeah, and this is a problem of not being able to see the forest for the trees. When you are down in it every day, you're running your business, you're not a technology expert, you don't know what's possible, or even if you do, you just don't necessarily have the perspective, because as humans, we just get into these ruts, for lack of a better word, that just take us forward on the path that we've already, that we're most comfortable with. So I'm pulling two lessons out of this from what you're saying. The first is to make sure that you work with a strategic-minded provider. So whatever software solution or hardware solution or tech that might be, a good provider is going to be somebody who has what you've just described in the labs, somebody who can come in and provide an outside perspective on how to solve problems that they may not be able to see. And the second is to leverage the perspective that you already have among your people that are already on your team. So for example, with digitally native younger generations that are coming in, or just people who, in general, regardless of their age or experience, who are interested in this kind of stuff, a lot of innovation and ideas can come out of those people if they are empowered to be able to experiment and to say, hey, you know what? I have an idea to reduce the failure rate on this particular part or whatever it may be.
Absolutely. And I think I heard a really good term for it, which was reverse mentoring, you know, where, like, you know, the mentorship relationship kind of changes, where, you know, these people that come with expectations from the consumer world, from everything they've, you know, lived and breathed to date, and they come into the marketplace, they come into the shop floor, you know, we need to listen to them, because they'll be able to just bring that external view, which is very important, but also tie it to kind of, you know, what they know is possible. And so you can then ask the right questions. And, you know, the labs is one example where we do that. We do customer advisory boards. We have forums where customers can share their innovations. And, you know, the good thing is manufacturers, they can, you know, make anything. So we, some of our customers, you know, you give them an idea, you give them a kind of, you know, a bit of a direction, and they run with it and come back with something you couldn't have even imagined yourself. So, you know, that's pretty, pretty cool to see.
Yeah, and that's a really positive aspect of it. So on that note, I would like to continue that theme and look at a success story. Let's talk about what it looks like when this goes right. Tell me about a situation when this has gone absolutely right and you've seen a real transformation in a customer's operations.
Okay, I'll take it to start with. So we'll touch on three, but I'll start with one that you probably don't realize is a customer, and many people won't. And also, it's sort of strange to think of as a manufacturer, but absolutely, you know, needs to be on the bleeding edge. So back in 2008, I was actually working with this customer, moving from this old, again, green screen system, which happened to be an old Epicor platform that we retired, to the, you know, the kind of latest breed of software. And, you know, it was a case of extracting all the data, getting it into the new system. And the reason for the move, you know, back in 2008 was, you know, because the old system was now, you know, they couldn't make the changes they needed fast enough. It required too much legacy code. It was too brittle. So moving to this kind of newer technology foundation was what they needed to be able to help them kind of succeed. Now, this company, you know, is a bit different to normal companies because it just makes one thing, but actually just one of them. Yeah. And it then races it. So this is Red Bull Formula One team, and the Red Bull car. And if you tracked the progression in the F1 from 2008, they started winning at that point. I'll take all the credit for that, even though it doesn't really apply. With that team, you know, very bright team, very forward-looking team, building out, you know, their foundation for keeping track of the car, keeping track of all the parts. You know, they've got a full manufacturing facility in Milton Keynes. And they've got lots of suppliers that feed them. And every time that car goes onto a a kind of race day, every event, every practice, you know, they're changing things. And they change things, you know, in a month, they might update their ERP system 25 to 30 times. And that is just like they change the car. They're tweaking things. They're printing, you know, less dense parts. They're testing them. They're verifying it. They're changing designs constantly. And they're doing the same thing on their ERP system, tweaking the process, refining the process, connecting machines, you know, getting, because, you know, they've got a limited amount of time for every window to get things done. So, you know, that's kind of interesting when you look at, you know, kind of, you know, how do, you know, how do companies deal with speed, deal with, you know, agility? I think Red Bull's a really good example of that. You know, their machines are all connected via the advanced MES system, the manufacturing execution system, so that, you know, the jobs are there, they can build the parts, they can prioritize and move things up and down. So when a new design looks promising, they can, you know, kind of expedite that through the factory, get it built, get it out, track where it is, you know, track all of the parts, how much race time they've had. You know, fantastic business to kind of, you know, be to work with, and, you know, a very strong team internally, and that's allowed them to keep pace, you know, with the kind of the race team. So, you know, that's a fun one. Systema are an interesting one. So based out of New Zealand, started in the garage, manufacturing plastic food containers and drinks. And, you know, before I even heard of them, you know, after I've heard of them, I then looked in the cupboard and, yeah, everything's got a Systema on its name. Just didn't even realize. So you might find that after listening to this podcast that you actually know them but didn't know them. And, you know, in New Zealand, they've got 20,000 square foot factory. And, you know, they had the challenge of, first of all, you know, injection molding, plastic containers, stackable containers, you know, in effect, scaling that operation from going from a garage to delivering to 110 countries around the world, you know, handling the container logistics of bringing in or sending out materials, you know, from New Zealand, and, you know, having a world-class facility that is, you know, all connected. So their machines are connected, you know, again, you know, a team of superstars that can, you know, kind of are connected, you know, with the mechanical engineers, the technical engineers working together from the shop floor, connecting PLCs back into their back-end system so that, you know, as everything is injected, as everything's created, it can be picked up, it can be moved on, it can be labeled correctly, you know, so that thing just becomes a whole automation piece. So, you know, Systema, I think, you know, and Red Bull, you know, are put together as kind of, you know, world-class kind of companies. But the last one I want to talk about is one that, again, everyone knows, but you might not know the story. And, you know, 1908, this company started. And in 1948, they really kind of had their first original manufactured product. And this was at the Black Cab, at the London Black Cab, London Taxi Company. And back in 2006, London Taxi weren't doing too well. They basically were struggling. They had investment from Geely, who's a Chinese company, also a manufacturer, car manufacturer. And this was the kind of start of the investment to really get LTI and what's now called the London Electric Vehicle Company back online. And so after that investment, you know, the reason they needed a new ERP system at the time was their current system was not able to deal with importing from China. You know, now all the parts were coming from China, or some of them were. And in the UK also, there was issues with being able to dip the body, which the facility that used to handle the dipping of the body for the paint was no longer available. The company had gone into receivership. So, you know, they were faced with this problem where their systems couldn't deal with the market conditions they were in. And so they looked for a new ERP system. And then in effect, we started working with them on that sort of transformation. But, you know, that was difficult because the business was strapped for cash. It was kind of struggling a little bit to kind of, you know, meet demands and implement an ERP system at the same time as dealing with, you know, kind of all these other things going on. And a takeover was very kind of difficult. But when you sort of look at them now, and so in 2017, you know, and 2016, we're involved, you know, with, in effect, the new facility, this £500 million pounds investment into the UK economy, into the first electric vehicle plant for taxis. You know, we got to work with them, again, another super team, that where you kind of started with a blueprint. Now, nobody, you know, it's kind of probably once in a lifetime you get the opportunity to sort of like start with a blueprint and have an investment and, you know, before you've even broken ground, start planning how these systems are going to talk to each other, you know, and the interactions between different companies that deal with the software BOM and different companies that deal with the painting of the parts and the configuration and how we're going to deal with the aluminium bonded body and the body shop and the production line. So, you know, when you can choose the tools and you're not starting with legacy, you're starting completely fresh, how would you do it? That was what we had the opportunity to work with LEVC on. And, you know, it's not been easy, but it's been, you know, very rewarding to watch them grow and continue to kind of beat sales expectations. And now we're just on the cusp of their new decade and then releasing the electric van, which is, you know, kind of now making its debut onto UK roads. And even, you know, across the world. So, you know, when you get to, in effect, plan how a completely new factory is going to be connected, how all the pieces of the shop floor MES system are going to talk to, you know, the VIN process, the flashing of the vehicle software, the fuel pumps, the testing, you know, it's pretty cool to see. So, those are the three examples, you know, I think we'll cover that just give you an idea of like how, you know, we see resurgence. Yeah, we see this company that went from this legacy base with LTI that managed to kind of like, you know, that strong brand that everybody recognized to now be, you know, sort of leading the way in electric vehicle manufacturing. And then we see the kind of speed that the F1 teams work at and then the scale at Sistema. You know, it shows you what's possible when you've got, you know, a really solid foundation. And critically, you've got the people that can sort of like, you know, think about the possible and actually make it turn it into reality.
Terry, you must have had an interesting perspective on this from the marketing side, because I know that you also have a lot of conversations with customers and they probably tend to take a little bit different of an angle. So what was it like witnessing these transformations? What did it look like before? What was the mood of the customer? And then what does it look like now?
Ultimately, I think all of these customers are solving problems, right? And I think Stephen did a great job illustrating it. You know, I'll speak to Sistema specifically, because I've had many conversations with their CIO and their executive team. You know, they're based in New Zealand. The CIO was telling me, or their chief technology officer, they had to rely on this technology because of the lack of labor that's available there. You know, he was telling me that in their factory, their demand was so high, they didn't have enough people to pick inventory off the shelves to ship out. And no matter what they did, they just didn't have the pool of labor that they needed to keep up with demand. So they were forced to, you know, go into to look at technology. What else can we do to solve this problem? Because we've got inventory, we've got everything met. We just can't kind of fill that last mile, right? In getting the stuff off the shelves, packed and sent off to where it needs to be sent off to. And so they started looking at these cobots and you know, robotic factories in order to meet this demand. And so I think that all of the companies that Stephen mentioned are visionary. I think that they end up ultimately executing on these things because it's need. It's the need to be more competitive. It's the need to get shorter turns with your inventory and to accomplish all of these things. And it's ever evolving. You know, Systema continues to evolve how they are implementing automation across their factory. And so I think it's more of, you know, they were in a position that this was a problem that they needed to solve. It was a pain point, and they were able to leverage technology to and Epicor solutions to solve that. And they're on the other side of that now. And so they have these cobots in place now that help with their inventory and getting a product out. And now they're just looking for the next thing. And so it continues to evolve. And where else can they apply this technology? I know they're looking a lot at analytics now and, looking to implement IoT on their shop floor for their machines. And so it's kind of one project after another, but certainly it seems to be underscored by this, you know, acute need to really solve a problem quickly.
I agree. There's this fine line between reacting to what is absolutely critical to keep your business running in the moment. And in this case, you have too much demand with Systema. That's a really good problem to have, but ultimately it is a problem and it's driving you to do something and do it immediately. So there's a fine line between that reactivity and the visionary side, which is saying, look, we want to make sure that we're in a position to be able to continue to respond quickly, especially to great unknowns like the pandemic. And so you've described both kinds of customers. The majority of the market seems to be now waking up to saying, we have to do something. And now there's an actual timeline in the sense that things will never go back to the way they were before the pandemic. We won't have some of the people who were furloughed won't come back. They will be replaced. Their roles will be replaced by technology by necessity. And that creates a feedback loop. And not only that, we've got all of these new technologies coming online that are going to enhance the digital core. So with that in mind, what I'd like to find out is from each of you, Terry, we'll start with you. What would be the one key takeaway that you would leave a manufacturing or distribution executive leader with in terms of what they should be doing to be able to take the next step? Like, what is the most urgent thing that you want to impart?
Well, from a high level, you know, I love Stephen's talk about the art of the possible, and that especially for mid-size, you know, small and mid-size companies, these aren't technologies that small and mid-sized companies should feel like they are priced out of or are too complex, or that they, you know, need to be $1 billion in revenue for it to have any ROI. These are all technologies that the smallest manufacturer can consider using. And as you start to implement these technologies can help level the playing field with bigger competitors, you know, and so when you're looking for a competitive edge, when you're looking to, you know, right now in this environment, it's just to survive and to, you know, hopefully thrive. It's not to that you shouldn't be intimidated by this, that there is a path to understanding and implementing these, you know, regardless of your size, and that you should look to your technology provider to as a partner and not just as that provider, but as a solution provider to help build that path forward for you. And so I guess last message to leave is don't be intimidated by this. There is a way that you can leverage this technology and you too can be successful, you know, no matter how small you are, no matter how your resources may be limited.
Okay, so I'd say that data is your most valuable asset and your most valuable tool. And so your ERP system allows it to compound. And, you know, when you think about ERP projects, you know, and you're given like a kind of date, the ERP project is never done. It's a constant thing, because if you stop innovating, you stop competing. So, you know, if anybody's got ERP systems, you know, on other platforms as well, you know, keep it evergreen, keep it up to date. Invest time in making it better and making your data better, because ultimately your data is what differentiates you from your competition. It's what stops someone else coming up and doing exactly the same thing. And the more you can enrich it, the more you can refine it, the more valuable you'll be.
Yeah, and that is a powerful takeaway. So guys, I think we're going to have to wrap up there. So Terry, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us. This has been a fun discussion.
No, thank you. It's been great.